Still looking for a great summer read? Well, maybe one you can peruse while you pick at a lime Jell-O mold salad with marshmallows and shredded carrots is Allie Rowbottom's Jell-O Girls, recently out in paperback. Yes, the book is about Jell-O and girls.
Do you know what makes a little girl happy? Twinkling Jell-O. There's nothing quite like Jell-O. It's a wonderland of delight.
But Jell-O was anything but a wonderland for the women in Allie Rowbottom's family, who inherited the Jell-O fortune, millions, and what they said was the Jell-O curse. Allie's grandmother, her mother, and Allie all felt forced to be as perfectly molded as a Jell-O dessert. She traces the history of Jell-O. Her uncle bought the patent in 1899 for $450. The family sold it years later for $67 million. Her family members suffered alcoholism, eating disorders. The town of Leroy, New York, where Jell-O was made until it suddenly wasn't. And women in the kitchen. The cover of her book shows an orange Jell-O mold with what looks like a Barbie trapped inside. Again, Allie Rowbottom's terrific book is Jell-O Girls, A Family History. We spoke last August. Well, you begin the book almost at the end, you taking care of your mother as she dies from the cancer that's just tortured her almost her whole life. And as she's dying, the only thing she can eat is Jell-O, which she hated and avoided her whole life. Talk about the irony there.
At the end of my mother's life, she accepted it, but for much of her life, she avoided Jell-O, seeing it as sort of a symbol of patriarchy on a broad scale, but also of her own family's struggle against patriarchal forces and against what they thought of as a Jell-O curse. So at the end of her life, when it turned out that Jell-O was the only thing that she could stomach, it was this sort of grim irony. Unfortunately, it wound up being the last thing she ever ate. Mm.
Talk a little bit about Jell-O, because there's a storyline here. It's kind of the history of food in America and new domestic science technology. You know, you just put in hot water. So simple, even a child can do it, which, of course, infers that women at home doing this are childlike. But talk about how it was sold to them in this idea of domestic science.
Well, Jell-O's marketing really took hold around the onset of the Industrial Revolution. Many American women were losing a lot of their help in the kitchens to factory work that was more lucrative and probably more rewarding in a lot of senses for people who had previously worked in the kitchens of the middle classes. So many American women were finding themselves unsure of how to prepare the recipes that they had grown used to eating. But Jell-O came around and sort of had a double hook in that it was so easy to prepare, but it was also this new scientific food at an age where America was really privileging science and technology. It compelled its audience.
Never mind that it had dyes and more sugar than, you know, and made from what, the hooves of animals?
Now I think it's made more from boiled hides and skins, but at the time it was rendered from hooves and bones.
And women were encouraged to do what with it?
It could be a breakfast, but it was also a salad, but then it could also be a dessert. So it was very versatile and it really molded itself, if you will, to people's palates.
Well, early on, Jell-O commissioned Norman Rockwell to illustrate cookbooks and advertisements. Interesting, because when your mom is actually committed to an institution, there's a rumor that Rockwell is there as well. And he did, we now know, have a lot of mental health issues. So your mom wasn't the only one who couldn't adhere to this perfect image that Jell-O was presenting to the world. But bring us to the point that your mother came to, that Jell-O makes women silent.
My mother very overtly felt that Jell-O and sort of the larger American culture that it served as an icon for did contribute to what she saw as a patriarchal culture that contributed to silencing and oppressing women.
Well, and talk about your mom and her story, which you clear-eyed tell. She was molested by friends of her brothers when she was a very young girl, lured into having sex with what sounds like a lecherous married cousin, then, as we said, went to the Austin Riggs Mental Hospital at the age of 19. After that, was, you know, you could say promiscuous in her life that she was trying to craft, getting away from the family and its fortune and be an artist in her own right. What was that like to write about?
It was a really moving experience, honestly. I mean, I started this book before she died, but it really wasn't until after she died and I experienced grief and loss that I really understood why she had behaved the way she had for most of her life. For example, on birthdays and Christmases, she would send us presents from her own dead mother. I always found that strange, and now I completely understand it.
Well, her mother died so young.
Yes, and I think all of my mother's behaviors could really be traced back to that initial loss. And like I said, it really wasn't until I lost my own mother that I understood that about her, and I could look at her memoir that she left behind with a whole new perspective.
Because she had wanted to write the book that you ended up writing.
She had. She had tried for much of my life to write a memoir of her girlhood and adulthood and to braid in this idea of the curse of patriarchy and how it connected within her family and how it probably, in her mind, connected in most women's lives.
There's so many characters in here. Jell-O's a character, your mom, of course, your grandma. And also the town, Leroy, New York, where Jell-O was king. And then when Jell-O left the town was decimated. But you trace that fall in Leroy to another storyline in your book. You and your mother were captivated by a news story that we remember of a group of young girls in Leroy who had an inexplicable outbreak of something that nobody could describe. They had tics. They couldn't control their limbs. This also happened in Leroy, the home of Jell-O. What do you conclude about that?
So the girls were initially a mystery and later diagnosed with conversion disorder and mass psychogenic illness, conversion disorder being the conversion of emotional trauma or stress into physical symptoms, and then mass psychogenic illness being sort of tagged on to the end as the mysterious spread of these symptoms through groups with no real reason for it having spread. So that was the resultant conclusion that doctors made through a process of elimination. My mom really felt that these girls were very obviously responding involuntarily to a culture that was particularly strong in Leroy of silencing women. And so as she and I both knew through our own experiences, when one's voice is silent, oftentimes the body finds other ways to speak.
Well, and for you and your mom, you had this mysterious, like, paralysis of your hands. They would, like, shape into a claw.
Yeah, that had happened to me before I knew that it had happened to her. And it wasn't until much later when I went back through her memoirs that I saw that.
How do you draw the Jell-O curse to your own storyline, which is you had a serious eating disorder? At one point, you were only eating sugar-free Jell-O.
Yeah, so I think that like the girls in Leroy and like my mother before me, a lot of my struggle traced back to not feeling free to speak once I started to speak and express myself in therapy and to learn that it was safe to do so. My symptoms became less present.
And by the way, one of the things you couldn't speak about was that your father was having an affair with one of your teachers, but told you that what you were seeing with your own eyes wasn't true. Boy, it gets intensely personal. But again, as we said, also takes a step back and looks at the history of Jell-O. And there's another irony here, because when we think Jell-O, we think this guy.
We're here to celebrate a different way to eat Jell-O gelatin. With our bare hands.
It's just so interesting to be reminded that Bill Cosby was the voice of Jell-O for decades and turned out to be someone who also had repressed women.
Yeah, as the face of Jell-O, he, on the surface, projected this equal parts daddish and infantile persona. But as we know now, he was really also the face of a certain kind of tradition of silencing women or working to keep women silent.
Well, he allegedly gave them knockout pills.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What have people said to you about this? Jell-O holds such a place in people's minds. Have they been upset about how you've cast it? Or what are you hearing?
Well, first of all, I've heard a lot of wonderful stories of people's childhood relationships with Jell-O. I've been gifted recipes. I've been gifted old cookbooks. A lot of people don't see this book as portraying Jell-O necessarily negatively. I will say that there are some people maybe connected to Leroy who don't feel great about the book. It's a challenge as a writer to write honestly of a place or a person, but also to, you know, not portray it as any one thing.
And how about you? Do you feel you have broken the Jell-O curse?
I hope so. I do feel that, you know, I have sounded my voice and my mother's. It's a constant challenge, I think, probably with anyone who puts a book out into the world, but for this book in particular, to stand behind my work and to stick to my guns when, you know, there are many who are coming forward, or some who are coming forward, I should say, who are proving the point of the book in some ways and trying to shut me up. So I think it just proves the importance of work by women that challenges the norms that we still live with and norms that would see us stay silent.
Allie Rowbottom's book is Jell-O Girls, A Family History. Allie, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jell-O Girls author Allie Rowbottom. The book is now out in paperback. It's here and now.